Welcome to Into the Colaverse, a podcast that takes us on the unique journeys of faculty in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. Join me, your host, Frederick Luis Aldama, as we learn of the many ways that our faculty and their cutting-edge work is transforming the world today.
It's my great pleasure and honor to have Art Markman, Annabel Arian Worsham Centennial Professor of Psychology and Marketing, as well as Vice Provost of Academic Affairs. Welcome, Art.
It is great to be here. Thanks so much.
So, Art, already with this incredible title that you have, there sounds like there might be a story there. Maybe it's a story that we can get to immediately or where the journey will take us. I do want to talk a little bit about how you ended up in cognitive science at Brown, but maybe we should start with that incredible title that you have.
Well, I mean, I was fortunate enough to get a professorship with an endowment on it. But you know, when I saw it for the first time, the name on it is Annabel Arian Worsham, and that second name, Arian, I-R-I-O-N. When you look at that, you actually, it's not obvious how you pronounce it. And for many years, I actually didn't know how to pronounce it. And so people would come up to me before I gave a talk and they'd say, I have a question for you. And I'd say, I don't know. And they'd say, I haven't asked the question yet. I said, no, but I know what the question is going to be and I don't know. And they'd say, well, let me ask the question. How do you pronounce the middle name in this? I said, I don't know. And then maybe 6-7 years ago, I was sitting with an older alum of UT when I was director of the IC Squared Institute. And halfway through the conversation, he said something about, oh, I knew Arian Worsham. I said, wait, stop. What did you just say? And he said, yeah, Arian Worsham. And I went, okay, this is great. So after all of those years, I suddenly had the pronunciation of the name. I was so excited.
So good. Because yes, I needed help with the pronunciation. absolutely. So yeah, well, you've got this title for a reason. You're absolute kind of incredible productivity, a productivity that actually reaches way beyond classrooms, way beyond the university. In a way, it's a kind of exemplar, an embodiment of, you know what we aim to do as university professors, right? But it begins long before you started publishing your mini books and your podcasts, all of the public-facing work that you do, Psychology Today, the Harvard Review, all of that. But tell me, cognitive science, 1988, Brown, what led you to a degree in cognitive science? I know that you have a deep interest, more than interest, passion for history and literature. Why cognitive science?
You know, like so many people, I went to college not really knowing what I wanted to study and being profoundly influenced by people around me. So my mother was a teacher, my father was an accountant. So I don't know, I thought, well, maybe I should be an accountant, but Brown, where I was an undergraduate, didn't have a business school. So I thought, well, maybe I'll study economics, but I also sort of liked physics when I was in high school. So I thought, well, maybe I'll take physics and do that. So my first year in college, I took economics and I didn't like it. It didn't resonate for me. I took a couple of economics classes and it didn't really work for me. And I took a physics class and it didn't like me at all. I did not do well in that. And so I drifted actually for a couple of years in college. I took a lot of classes. There were a lot of things I enjoyed, but I wasn't sure what to major in. And I had to declare what at Brown they called a concentration. And I had an advisor who sat down with me at the end of my sophomore year and said, it's really time to declare a concentration. What do you want to study? I said, I really don't know. I said, but I took a psychology class. I kind of liked it, but I don't think I want to be a psych major. And I took a neuroscience class and I liked that, but I don't really want to be a neuroscientist. I took a linguistics class and I liked that, but I don't really think I want to be a linguist. I took an anthropology class. I liked that. I don't think I really want to be, And I kind of And I got to the end of this list, and the advisor looked at me and said, you realize every single thing you're describing to me counts towards the major in cognitive science. Is it possible you're a cognitive scientist? And I realized that what I liked about all of these different disciplines was that they were providing this different lens on human thinking and human behavior. But and that what I liked was being able to take that variety of different vantage points. And so I ended up declaring that concentration in cognitive science, and actually did most of my undergraduate coursework in computer science, and much less in some of these other areas. But back in the 1980s, when I was a college student, computers were small and slow and didn't have a lot of data associated that you could process. And so, so I remember then being in taking a graduate seminar in artificial intelligence about the spring of 1987. Yeah. And I remember we read a paper on how robots could learn to navigate a space. And it started with a little experiment that the author of the paper did on people learning to navigate a space, and then built a little computer model that mimicked what people were doing. And at the very beginning of class, the professor teaching the class made a disparaging comment about doing an experiment like that. And, you know, we should just do the computational work. And I remember raising my hand and giving an impassioned 5-minute defense of the importance of doing experiments to understand intelligent behavior, while the other graduate students who were taking this class, I was one of the few undergrads in the class, the graduate students taking the class were looking at me in horror because I was disagreeing fundamentally with the faculty member teaching it. And as they were staring at me like this, and I was giving this little diatribe, I realized I might be a psychologist. And at that moment decided, okay, I'm going to pursue graduate studies, but I'm going to do it in psychology and become a cognitive psychologist. And then went from Brown to ended up luckily getting into Illinois, which was a wonderful cognitive psychology program and going there. But having that multidisciplinary background was incredibly helpful, because I think it's humbling to realize that there is no single discipline that actually has the answer for anything, and that you have to be willing to take multiple vantage points and listen to experts from multiple perspectives if you're actually going to understand anything complicated.
Is that also the inspiration for Human Dimensions of Organizations?
It's interesting. I mean, it certainly plays a role in why I resonated so much to that as an approach. So, you know, the interesting thing about the Human Dimensions of Organizations program was, this was back in 2011, 2010 and 2011. So Mark Music was one of the associate deans, and he and Amy Ware, who was an American Studies PhD, who was working in the dean's office, had put a lot of effort into thinking about the prospect of creating some kind of liberal arts-based master's program that might appeal to people in business. And they found some historical precedents for that in some work that got done at Penn. And at that point, the dean's office reached out to me and asked if I'd be willing to talk to them about how this might get operationalized. And I immediately, I think maybe because of this background in thinking about multidisciplinarity, I found it really appealing. And I remember taking the document that they wrote, saying that we should build a master's program, and writing a 4-page response, that I titled The Human Dimensions of Organizations, and said, and sort of gave my addition to the really great work that they did. And it was a fascinating thing, because you know, we often call the pace of change at universities glacial because we don't know anything slower than a glacier. But actually, they reached out to me. It was about the first week of February of 2011. And they gave me that we had a meeting and they gave me that initial document that Mark Music and Amy Ware had written. And then the following week, I sent a document back and we had another meeting. And on March 1st, so about 3.5 weeks later, they committed to creating the program. And Amy Ware actually transferred from the dean's office into the fledgling program. And we were off recruiting people to engage them in this new venture. And it was just so much fun. And I think it was that same thrill of recognizing that so many of us in liberal arts have a deep passion for understanding people from our perspective and a wealth of knowledge that a lot of other people would benefit from understanding. And so, you know, we just ran around the college describing what we were interested in doing and just thankfully got a number of people who were willing to commit time to a dream and put together a group and ultimately developed the master's program and then, you know, the non-credit classes and finally the undergraduate program. But it was so much fun and there was just so much to learn from just all the different people that we brought together. It was really the kind of couple of years that we spent in developing the master's program were so much fun.
You're as vice provost of academic affairs and as a professor, is this in many ways the kind of ideal model for a university? I mean, if we scaled it up, or is it actually a scaled down version of the university, depending on our perspective? In other words, and I guess related, what is, I guess, your ideal, your utopia for learning, you know, at the college level, at the university level?
Yeah, so interesting. I mean, I would say that where I think that what we did with Human Dimensions of Organizations was something that we should continue to strive for is more in being willing to try some things that go beyond the traditional boundaries of how we've structured college education. So, you know, it's funny, we build departments, which are basically accounting structures, right? They're ways of doling out money. We build departments around things that are intellectually valuable at a particular period of time. So, you know, there was a period of time where history was the discipline people needed to study. And so we have a history department and we have departments like that are very old. And then, you know, there are times where we have the rise of new types of disciplines. And so then we will get newer departments that are organized in different ways. And so, you know, a program that is organized around a theme, you know, can then become a department, and that gets solidified into that kind of accounting structure. But intellectual inquiry and intellectual engagement and education don't stop at the point where we reify stuff into accounting structures. And so, you know, I think what happens is we then often feel like we have to keep perpetuating only the stuff that we built into the department structure, when there may also be other things, other ways of trying to engage students or trying to engage research or trying to engage scholarship that would benefit from a different approach. And so, you know, it's the tension is, how do you continue to be flexible when money wants to be orderly? And so, you know, that's, I think, the challenge that universities face. And I think the joy of engaging with Human Dimensions of Organizations was it was a chance for all of us to escape our particular accounting structures and get together to do a new thing. And by building it as a program rather than a department, it didn't have a fixed budget coming from somewhere else. But there was an added advantage that because HDO was built initially as you know, what we affectionately call an option three program, which is a self-sustaining graduate program. We did have money that was able to support the program that was coming from the students who signed up for the master's program and the other classes. So it was entrepreneurial in nature, but it was also intellectually just, you know, stimulating and great fun. And I think creating opportunities for people to find ways to think about things differently and to pursue those things in a different way that escapes the way that money usually flows is something that universities need to continue to learn to do so that we can be responsive to new disciplines, new scholarship, and new education. And I think that, you know, in my role now as in administration, a lot of what we think about is how can we do that? How can we promote flexibility in thinking and you know, in education in particular, how do we meet the students where they are? Right. And that's, you know, not to do it in a way that reduces the rigor of what we do, but rather brings the level of scholarship and rigor that we have as faculty to the kinds of issues and problems that our students are eager to learn to solve and will be asked to solve when they leave the university in a rapidly changing world.
Mm. Yeah, I could see this as a kind of a part two to your 2019, bring your brain to work, rather bring your brain to, I don't know, making the college, the higher education environment new. Yeah, really exciting. You know, I give these mock lectures for admissions to prospective students that come to campus. And I love doing that. One of the questions I ask them, just to, like you were saying, kind of be responsive to our those coming in and the questions they have. I actually ask them the question, why college? And it's fun to hear their, you know, very varied responses to that. Of course, better job, the usual stuff, right? Exploratory learning. And let's just say a hypothetical, bring your brain to college. What would that book look like for you, Art?
Yeah. You know, I think that, you know, we need two versions of that book, right? We need one book for college faculty, and then we need one version for college students. And they need to be I think complementary versions of this of the book that help us to begin to achieve a consensus about what we want to accomplish from a college education standpoint. And I think one of the things that I think we've seen, and this is one of the reasons why it's actually fun that in my portfolio in the provost office we also have continuing education in the mix, is that there was a real move in the continuing education space for a long time towards what were called boot camps. Like if you wanted to learn to be a coder, you'd take a 12-week coding boot camp. And for a while, people were taking those boot camps and companies were hiring them out of the boot camp to fill roles that they needed for coders. And there was a growing dissatisfaction in among employers for the graduates of these boot camps. And the reason that they were dissatisfied was that there was this feeling that the graduates could solve problems that they had seen in the boot camp and close cousins of those problems. But if you gave them a new problem, then they got lost. What you got out of college graduates, what you got out of master's degree students was a not just a skill at coding, for example, but also an ability to take a new problem and really put it into its context and understand it and develop an approach to it that was novel, that went beyond just being able to write code. And that, you know, if you think about what disciplinary thinking does for somebody, I mean, you know, certainly for those of us who are scholars, it helps us to push the boundary of knowledge within our area of scholarship. We have methods that are particular to our discipline, and we have content that's particular to it, and we leverage that to find a new problem that nobody's characterized in what we think is the right way yet, and then we use our discipline to expand the range of knowledge in that discipline, you know, and that's, you know, that's what keeps us excited and writing books and writing papers and things like that. But I think that you know, equally important is that our students are learning a discipline in order to have some base for solving problems that haven't been solved yet that they're going to face in the workplace. And where we need the book, the Bring Your Brain to College, for one version for faculty and one for students, is in helping us as faculty to remember that we need to help our students to be able to articulate not just this is the discipline you studied and this is what it might mean to be a scholar in that discipline, but also, even if you choose not to be a scholar, these are the ways that the things that we have taught you are going to help you to face the world and break down any problem that you find in a way that is going to give you insight into that and methods for addressing that problem that are unique to the intellectual background you've gotten as a college student. And then on the college student side, to kind of explain the importance of having the discipline, not just disciplinary knowledge, but in some ways the other sense of the word discipline, the willingness to use the knowledge and skills that you've attained to really focus on intractable problems and turn them into things where you can begin to get some purchase on them, and to help students to do that in ways that allow them to help prospective employers to understand what they're bringing to the workplace. You know, I mean, particularly in the College of Liberal Arts, you know, a lot of times people will say, well, why would anyone get a degree in, you know, and you know, you pick your favorite discipline to make fun of, you know, somebody, why would you get a degree in philosophy? You know, are you going to be a philosopher? Well, you know, philosophy is brilliant at helping people to understand the hidden assumptions that go into things that people take for granted, and then take those assumptions, pick them apart, and understand the implications of those for the way that people are thinking about something moving forward, which makes philosophers often incredibly valuable for organizations for helping them to get unstuck by recognizing some of those hidden assumptions that they're making, which is one of the reasons why, if you actually look at the data relating to wages that people are making, which is a proxy for the value they're providing for companies, that philosophy majors do pretty darn well, you know, in the workplace a few years out. So it's, you know, we may need to give our philosophy students and other students a little, you know, a little more help in articulating the value that they bring on day one, but they're clearly going to be bringing value, you know, in year five. Mm-hmm. And I think that's to me the thing that we have to continue to improve is that ability to help all of our students across the university to be better at recognizing that the value that a college degree really provides is this ability to be able to look at the world and take a disciplinary stance that allows you to see the assumptions that people are making, to have methodologies for gathering information and data to help you look at that problem in a different way and bring insights that in the absence of that disciplinary knowledge no one would be able to come up with. And college students do that exceptionally well. It's the value of having a degree. It's the value of having an advanced degree for those students who go on to get master's degrees and PhDs. It's incredible. It's an incredibly important part of what the liberal arts experience is about. And so, you know, I think we just need to help students to understand that, because, you know, in part because the national discussion around college education has tended to focus purely on ROI, as if, you know, it your first year's wages are somehow a statement of how good your degree was, and as if we should be focusing primarily on the skills that are going to help you to get that first job. And the problem is, no matter what you're studying, you know, even if you're studying something at the leading edge of a science or technology area, the knowledge that you learn in college is going to be obsolete in 5 years. So you know, the world's going to move on. And so if you don't learn how to learn, and you don't learn how to take big, ugly, unstructured problems and turn them into something manageable, and if you don't learn how to get along with people and to work as a team and to manage a large project that involves lots of people coming together to make a contribution, if you don't learn those kinds of skills, then you're not gonna survive for a career length amount of time in any area.
Mm-hmm. In fact, in one of your public-facing pieces for Psychology Today, part of the title is Appreciating the Discomfort of Learning. But let me ask you, so there's so much here, Art, that you are sharing with us and our listeners. You mentioned all the way back in 87, AI. In 98, I believe you've published your first book, Knowledge Representation, and books either a year kind of after each, you know, or a couple of years, but a number of books since then, including one, Brain Briefs, if I read this right, that is something based on the KUT radio show with mm-hmm. Bob Duke. But today, 23, 87 AI, nine, and then 98 Knowledge Representation, and now today we have ChatGPT, conversation alarm all over. We have smartphones, we have social media that is just, I mean, the big rabbit hole of our lives. Front-facing cameras now, and we've had them for a while, that are causing all sorts of things. So I suppose the big question is, in your research, and I know you're very current, you're constantly writing and putting stuff out there, what's advanced, what new questions are being asked, and what have we still kind of fixed to from 87 AI?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. So way back as an undergrad, my undergraduate honors thesis was on neural networks, you know, and using, you know, versions of some of the tools that ultimately end up being embedded in these large language models that are now the basis of things like ChatGPT. So the math associated with these is old. You know, it's a number of people have heard about Jeff Hinton, who was working for Google. He's the guy who resigned from Google after some of the AI models started to come out. I jokingly said on social media at one point that he may have woken up one day and realized he was the one that they came back in one of the Terminator movies to kill. The techniques have been around a long time and have been in development. What's changed is, you know, I mean, some of the techniques have been improved, but a lot of what's changed is also computing power and our ability to run these kinds of models over large enough data sets that that we can pick up those subtle statistical interactions among words in a huge corpus of text. And so, you know, in some ways, it's we're getting to the absurd but logical conclusion of movements that started 35, 40 years ago, which I find personally fascinating, right? And I generally see tools as opportunities, not threats. I mean, in the short term, we have to learn how to grapple with them. But in the long term, my question is, what are these going to enable us to do that we couldn't do before, right? And mm-hmm. you know, I mean, actually, you know, actively, one of the things that we're doing in academic affairs right now is beginning to think about. So, are there things that have been historically difficult to teach that maybe these large language models might make easier to teach? You know, for example, it's notoriously difficult to teach people to write, you know, and we have great writing faculty in the writing mm-hmm. center and you know, we have lots of wonderful people who've been who work on this. You know, it's an interesting question about whether there are things that these models might provide that might create particular templates for specific lessons that might give mm-hmm. people more experience at audience design or at revision or mm-hmm. at some other aspect of the writing process that yeah. has historically been difficult to teach. I mean, maybe not, but to me, it's an interesting opportunity. It's something that we get to pursue and play with. And so I find all of these tools to be fascinating. And, you know, watching colleagues of mine here and at other universities who use social media as a way of gathering data about people, which has been fascinating as well, because people are leaving behind lots of trails of their thinking and their attitudes and their beliefs. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of data to be mined there. So for us both as scholars and educators, I think there's a tremendous amount of opportunity here. So it's true that when ChatGPT dropped, you know, the first thing was alarm, you know, education as we know it is over. And to the extent that education as we know it is over, that's a good thing, because I think those elements that we knew were probably not the best of our education. You know, the stuff that really enables a student who's learning something to truly demonstrate their skills is, you know, goes way beyond stuff that ChatGPT is going to spit out. And so, you know, if it forces all of us to take a big step back and ask, are we really asking students to do things that are pushing them to learn the kinds of critical thinking skills that we think are so important, you know, then I think it will have been a benefit to us mm-hmm. to have to grapple with that. And you know, so I find this generally to be I think a really exciting time, and we're, you know, we try to engage with as many people across campus as we can to get involved in thinking about these kinds of questions. You know, I think the other nice thing is we're at UT is what a fun place to work, right? I mean, as the flagship institution for a large state, it's a chance to really have an impact, not just on our own students, but on the entire university system. So I think many people at you know, in the system office and in you know, at other system schools are, you know, they do look to UT Austin to find out if there are things that we can do that would that they might benefit from. So I think it's a great time.
Mm, I do too. It's you know, I teach this UGS course. Undergraduate study course titled Smartphone Storytelling Wellness. And there, and also in my intro to comic studies, in the syllabus, I'm like, look, you want to use ChatGPT to help you outline a paper? Fine, just cite it. Mm. You know, et cetera. You know, this is a tool. It's out there. Let's embrace it. Let's use it and see, you know, how it can be helpful. Just let me know. No big deal.
I think the next generation of this is going to be you know, really structuring lessons around it. I mean, suggesting, hey, you know, try this, right? Mm-hmm. Try, you know, build that outline, but now do this with it, you know, and you know.
Yeah, it's interesting because on Fridays for the discussion board in the groups that I've allocated, one, so they rotate, but every week one will ask ChatGPT a question that relates to what we did in class. And then they will respond critically to how ChatGPT responded to that question. Yeah. Again, it's there. Let's engage it. Is there in your kind of omnivorous approach to all of life's questions, and you definitely have so much to offer in terms of giving us deep insight into all sorts, right? So engaging your neighbor and the significance and importance of that, why we feel younger than we are, which of course, you know, for someone like me, oddly, you know, in my age, I still think of myself as 18, right? Lying, people tell lies, being charismatic at work. But is there actually a black box to your research or your questions? Is there something that has simply just like has you flummoxed? You no idea.
Oh, you know, I think there's huge amounts of stuff, you know, because I mean, I think the difficulty is, you know, one of the reasons I like taking this variety of different disciplines and learning from them is because every discipline has biases associated with it. And, you know, when we think about, you know, in cognitive science, I mean, if you're a psychologist, you study individuals, right? Generally speaking. And yet people have to function as part of social groups. So yeah, we're going to have to draw from sociology to understand some of that, but also we come pre-programmed with relatively little knowledge, you know, compared to most other species. And so we also have to understand the influence that culture has on how we develop thinking processes. And so, you know, and so to me, the black box is it's less a black box and more just a recognition of how much there is to know in order to really get purchase on any question that you want to understand really deeply. You know, there's always another vantage point that you can take. And that vantage point isn't always a science or a social science, right? I think the other thing that I've come to appreciate more and more as I've gotten older is also the tremendous wisdom that comes from learning more history and understanding the thought processes that leaders went through in different facets of their lives. I've spent the last several years, I've picked Jeremy Suri's brain a little bit, for example, to try to get recommendations for presidential biographies to listen to, because I feel like I learn a lot of things from those, but I even learned something about my own discipline of cognitive science from trying to think through how leaders in different situations have had to deal with the context in which they find themselves, you know, which is something that often doesn't emerge, that sort of perspective doesn't emerge from a lot of psychology studies, where we do our best to control that context as much as possible and put everyone on a fairly equal footing. So, you know, to me, it's just that recognition that anything that I've ever cared about in, you know, from a scholarly perspective, that there's so much out there I don't know yet. And so, you know, and I think the other thing that's been fun for me is, way back in the day, right, when people were first trying to classify species, you know, there was that distinction between the lumpers and the splitters, right? So somebody'd find a new skeleton or something, and there'd be a big debate over whether that represented a brand new species of being, or whether it was in fact just another example of an existing species. And there were biases, right? There were biases that some people tended to be lumpers. They tended to want to see each new skeleton as being just a variant of something that had been found before. And then there were splitters who wanted to take subtle differences between a new specimen and previous ones and say this on this basis, it's a different species. And I feel like in academia, in many, the reward structure of academia tends to reward splitters intellectually, right? That you come up with an idea and you make a name for yourself by demonstrating how your idea is different from everybody else's. And so there's a real tendency towards a proliferation of theories and a proliferation of explanatory approaches. And I have found over the years that I've become much more a lumper. Mm-hmm. That even across disciplines, I tend to look for things and to say, you know, to what degree does this feel like something that is an extension of something that we've seen somewhere else? And it's what's nice about it is that doesn't mean everything is an example of something that's been seen somewhere else. But by taking that approach, it says, okay, here's how far you can get by treating this new thing I just read about as an example of something I've seen before. And as a result, here's what's missing, right? So here's the place where this is actually a unique species of something versus a variant of something I've seen before. And I have found that to be really powerful to do, and partly powerful because it starts to force you to think about systems. And that's the other piece that not every discipline suffers from this, but some do, which is that if you think about research, in you know, all of us, you know, you get to a place like UT because you're contributing to the research literature in your discipline. And often that next contribution is to burnish the head of a pin in your discipline, right? You're going to make some subtle distinctions that other people in your discipline haven't made before. And so you're going to, you know, and that generates great intellectual argument and other things. And there's real value in really getting the fine points of things right. But it does tend to drive us to very specific research questions. And, you know, at some point, you know, when you think about writing papers and even sometimes books, those books are focused on the head of the pin. And they sometimes mention the pin. They rarely talk about other pins that look the same, or the pin cushion, or the table the pin cushion is sitting on. And I feel like, you know, a lot of the kinds of problems in the world for which our disciplines can play such an important role, it is that step back that ends up helping to recognize the value that our disciplines play in those bigger problems. And it's something that I think is important for us to communicate to students. But I found that by playing this game of trying to look at problems that I find interesting in wildly different disciplines. So you know, seeing what a historian might have to say, or a classicist, or someone who's studied a particular region of the world, and then asking the question: does this feel to me like something that's similar to something I've seen before? And in what ways? And in what ways is it not? I find it really brings me back to some of those system level issues that forces me to think less about the head of the pin and more about how do some of these pieces fit together, which I think has changed the way I teach. For example, I think it's led me to spend much more time in my teaching talking to students about the entire system of thinking rather than just memory and attention and problem solving and decision making as separate entities, but really to try to figure out, well, how do all those pieces fit together? And by learning to think about how pieces fit together, how does that change the way that you may approach every problem you solve?
A couple of things come to mind. Mario Bunge, the Canadian, and his concept of convergence and emergence, right? Systems, but also your Smart Change book, where you talk about engaging your neighbor. So, in fact, being neighborly, right? But so presidential biographies, and this is really the what's on your book stand question as we come to the end of our beautiful, wonderful conversation. So, what are you reading? What are you watching? What's engaging you? You mentioned presidential biographies,
So I've been working my way through some presidential biographies. Right now, I'm listening to a biography of Eisenhower, and that actually Jeremy Suri recommended, and I've been enjoying that quite a bit. Actually read his most recent book, Civil War by Other Means, recently, and really enjoyed that. I've been reading some science fiction. My one of my graduate advisors told me it's really important to have some genre of fiction that you can read quickly that also is on your book stand, so that you can get your reading speed back up over 10 pages an hour. Because when you're reading in any kind of scholarly work or complex work, then your reading speed slows way down, and you need to remember how to move your eyes across the page. And I've taken that advice. For him, it was mystery novels. For me, it's science fiction. And I've been reading. There's a series of books that started with the book Altered Carbon. I think they made a TV series out of one or two of those, but there's a whole series of books, and I've been reading those lately, and those have been great fun. I encourage people to come wandering over to my office. I've been building Lego models out of kits for fun. I can show you, nobody listening to this can see this, but because we've got video contact here, I've got a Concorde behind me that I built, and it's just, those are, it's not deeply creative work, but there's something satisfying about getting these things put together, and the design of them is just so beautiful and well done that there's just something really interesting about looking at how the designers chose to take this set of pieces and create something. I mean, on this Concorde, the landing gear go up and down if you kind of twist the tail of it. And that mechanism was really fun to build and to see how they put together. So, there's that. I took up the saxophone in my mid-30s and still try to play that. And my band broke up during COVID, which was unfortunate. I was playing in a ska band, and that was a lot of fun. I miss hanging out with that group of people, but something'll come up. So, I think there's a lot going on. And the other thing is I have over the last 5 or 6 years, I've made a much more concerted effort to try to stay in shape, we're talking about age. I feel young, but I'm 57, and it turns out to just be a lot more work to keep keep fit. So I never owned any exercise equipment. I used to go to the gym and swim and do some things like that. And during the pandemic, I bought what is now basically a Peloton showroom. I've got the Peloton bike and a tread and a rowing machine and things like that. And I've been trying to, and so my evening commute each day is after I leave the office, I go home and I spend 45 minutes on a piece of exercise equipment or doing something just to clear the day out of my head, which has from, I think, has had a wondrous impact on my mental health, no matter how. No, even on a day where it felt like everything went wrong, I do 45 minutes of exercise, and the stress is gone from that. And it reminds me that I'll go back to work tomorrow and the problems will still be there and I can fix them then.
Amazing. What a journey from, Brown and finding your way to cognitive science, which was the system for you that allowed for the convergence and emergence, a whole career filled with all sorts of incredible books, public-facing work all over the place, including your radio show, to Legos and sci-fi and Pelotonia. Yeah, wonderful. Thank you, Art, so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for asking me to do this. This is great fun.
Into the Colaverse is produced by the University of Texas at Austin's College of Liberal Arts. Sound engineering by the Liberal Arts Instructional Technology Services. You can find Into the Colaverse podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.